Yesterday, May 1st, thousands of people organized around the globe to celebrate International Workers' Day. In Toronto, the rally was organized by No One Is Illegal, and over 1,000 people came out, despite the rain. One of the rally's main themes was our dreams don't fit in their ballot boxes. But what exactly are we talking about when we talk about dreams? Here at the Health Justice Radio Collective, we salute International Workers' Day by calling for safe working conditions for all. We demand access for health care without fear. We recognize that equitable health care outcomes will never be achieved so long as systemic oppressions like racism, homophobia, and sexism persist. Yesterday, in Toronto, the streets were filled with migrants, workers, and allies who chanted, "Justice for immigrants, freedom for refugees." They called for justice in the streets because it is not being achieved in the courts. On Friday, in a historic decision, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that an Ontario law excluding farm workers from unionizing was constitutional. On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we speak with Evelyn Encalada Grez, a founding organizer with Justicia for Immigrant Workers and a doctoral student in the Department of Sociology and Equity Studies at the University of Toronto, about the gendered aspects of Canadian migrant work and about Friday's important court decision for the health of migrant workers.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi, Evelyn. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So, Evelyn, can you tell us about Justicia for Migrant Workers?
Justicia is an organizing radical political collective that started in 2001 after a few workers in Leamington, Ontario, organized a wildcat strike. And that history for us is quite important because it really reflects how workers have taken resistance, have imparted on their own resistance over the years, regardless of what the law says or doesn't say. They've always have found ways to fight back. And at the time, like now, collective bargaining was not a right, but workers still organized themselves, and they organized a labor stoppage that resulted in 21 of them being deported back to Mexico as a form of discipline, basically, on the part of the Mexican consulate at the time. The idea was, by the Mexican consulate, was to make an example out of them, that if other workers were going to go out of line, and that in that respect, according to their perspective, that they would be sent home. And I say deported instead of repatriated, because when deportation is a much more forceful word, that basically means that you're being sent home against your will. Mm-hmm. And so we were alerted to that labor stoppage and subsequent disciplining. And a group of us went to Leamington on a fact-finding mission to see what was going on. And it was incredible. We heard so many stories of maltreatment. We went to go look for workers that were from that particular farm, but instead we ended up meeting workers from other farms that told us, you know, story after story that told us how they were treated like animals, not like human beings, like machines, but like machines that didn't have the right to break down. Mm-hmm. And after that weekend, we never stopped going to Leamington, and we started reaching out more workers all over rural Ontario. Mm-hmm. And also the labor movement started getting much more interested in these quote-unquote unorganized workers. And the Global Justice Caravan Project was started. That was financed by the CLC at the time, the Canadian Labor Congress. Mm-hmm. And we would get resources from the Canadian Labor Congress to do our outreach work as volunteers. But then in 2002, we decided that we didn't want to operate within the hierarchy of organized labor, and we wanted to ensure that our work was a worker-led. And we wanted to ensure that we were operating within a system where we could actually dream, mm-hmm. and push for the impossible. And so we decided to form our own collective called Justicia for Migrant Workers that has been premised on not waiting for the law to tell us what we can or cannot do, which included, for instance, last year, organizing a protest, a walk that took 10 hours from Leamington to Windsor. It was the first ever demo of that sort where migrant workers took to the streets, and these are migrant workers primarily from this new temporary foreign worker program. The low-skill NOC-CND has a much longer term, but basically many of our allies didn't come out that that weekend because we were supposed to have gotten a permit from the police, but the police didn't want us to march at all. And so what we did, we had to change our route, but we still marched. And so that shows like the limits of the legal system here in Canada, that you have to have a permit in order to, you know, voice your concerns, in order to be out in the street. All we did was change our routes, but we didn't change the form of resistance that workers decided to take on. And so that's the type of work that we do. And I consider myself mostly a community organizer, not an activist. But it's, you know, the reason why I say community organizer is because our work is premised on strengthening community among workers. Workers are divided, united at the same time. They are engaged in very complex power dynamics as migrant workers, with all of the hierarchies of power that they are embedded in globally, and, you know, within their farms and nationally within this country and in their own country, even as transnational migrants. But our role is to strengthen migrant workers and to do so across linguistic lines as well. And so one of the things that we've always done from the beginning is getting the Jamaican workers, the Caribbean workers together with the Mexican workers, and now we're getting the Asian workers together with the Guatemalans and the Mexican workers. And even though it is very time-consuming to translate back and forth, but we have to counter those divide-and-conquer practices and that employers constantly use against them and their liaison officers. So that's some aspects of our work. We do much more, like with women, for instance. A lot of our work is also counseling, you know, being present to the women when they have all these issues that they want to talk about, and all of the things that they deal with relating to their gender roles and responsibilities that are ascribed to them.
I want to get to gender a little bit later, but I'm wondering if you can tell me about Friday's court decision and what went on there.
Okay, well, we found out actually just on Tuesday or Wednesday that this decision was going to be released on Friday. It was a Supreme Court decision. It was like the last decision that we were all waiting for to see if farm workers, whether they're migrants or not, were going to be allowed to unionize here in Ontario.
And What's the history behind that? Why aren't farm workers historically, why are they different from other groups of laborers?
Well, it's been argued that, you know, farm work is a sector that has to have different types of protections because it relates to, an essential service, an essential industry that we all depend on. So it's always been excluded from you know, the basic protections that other workers enjoy. For instance, in a lot of the Employment Standards Act doesn't apply to farm work, for instance. But really, when we think about the history, this goes way back. It relates to how agricultural work is so tied to slavery, and how over the years, you know, this slavery has modernized itself in different ways. But I was sure that, you know, the Supreme Court was going to rule for migrant workers, domestic farm workers, to have the right to unionize. So I was taken aback. But then I remembered the history of slavery. But it's quite crucial and quite alarming that it happened here in Ontario. Ontario is where the majority of of migrant farm workers who work as in agriculture here in Canada, and this recent decision does not only affect farm workers, but it sends a message across the rest of the country that collective bargaining is not a constitutional right. So it ends up degrading all of the rights that we have as workers, no matter what profession, what sphere, what occupation, what labor sector we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So these are really challenging times, and it just means that we have to really step it up, and that our work has to be completely multi-pronged. We can't expect the laws to redress the injustices that migrant workers and farm workers experience every day.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand correctly, farm workers are able to organize themselves, but there's no requirement that employers come to agreements with unions, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Like, workers could be part of an organization, be part of an association, but they can't enter into legally binding collective agreements.
Okay.
Where employers would be bound to, to also, of course, meet the requirements of the collective agreements that were negotiated with them. So there's nothing in the law that will press them to come to the table with migrant workers and their representatives,
mm-hmm.
or allies.
And if I understand, some of the things that migrant workers are interested in is healthier working conditions, basically.
Yes, definitely. But another thing that we have to keep in mind is that, when it comes to health, Ontario is basically the best case scenario when it comes to migrant workers and their health.
Mm-hmm.
They have workers' compensation. A lot of the Mexican workers have an additional insurance that they pay through the Royal Bank, the private insurance. And then they have, after 3 months of work, they're all supposed to get OHIP.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they seem to be protected and on paper, they have all of these of this access.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the practicality of how accessible healthcare is, it's actually not. For instance, with women, they have a lot of a lot of their issues deal with sexual and reproductive rights,
mm-hmm.
and health. And according to the contracts that many of the women are bound to through the Seasonal Cultural Workers Program, the SALP, which is like the long-standing program that's been around since 1966,
mm-hmm.
employers are responsible to take workers to the doctor, to the clinics. But what ends up happening is that management completely knows what's going on with their bodies. There
mm-hmm.
is no, they don't have any privacy whatsoever. So
mm-hmm.
women are, they're not going to be open about what's happening with their bodies, what they're doing with their bodies, when they have somebody from management who's translating for them, or who's, or sometimes they don't even speak the language
mm-hmm.
in order to be able to translate and get their concerns across very well. There's been cases of women who have been repatriated, deported, because their employers have found out that they're pregnant. And
mm-hmm.
so many times what women do is they keep their pregnancies from their employers and from their co-workers as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
but then that means that they're doing the same type of work that everybody else is doing, which is quite strenuous work in the countryside and
mm-hmm.
In farms. And some of them lose their, they have miscarriages, and some also they don't want to open up about their reproductive needs. They bring medication from them from Mexico and other
mm-hmm.
countries that is completely detrimental to their health, that causes a lot of internal bleeding,
mm-hmm.
And so they take their health into their own hands, it has quite detrimental effects on their bodies, and sometimes when they can't access abortion either, like they end up having to have children that they're not ready for as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all of these issues with the women in particular.
So you've recently published an article entitled Vulnerabilities of Female Migrant Workers from Latin America and the Caribbean in Canada, and you've already talked about some of those vulnerabilities. I'm wondering if you can first tell us, how many or what's the proportion of female farm workers in Ontario?
Well, right now, in Ontario, the numbers fluctuate between 3 to 4% of the total migrant labor force, at least under the Seasonal Cultural Workers Program.
Mm-hmm.
So although women's numbers are increasing little by little, they're still a minority, and those numbers, them being a minority within these programs, you know, makes them even much more vulnerable. Like in the times when, you know, we've advocated for in certain communities for there to be more outreach to migrant workers and more, like a more concerted effort on healthcare practitioners to make sure that there are services and that they know about the particular vulnerabilities of migrant workers as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And when we try to advocate for women,
mm-hmm.
they will tell us, but you know, they will come back to us and tell us, but why should we if they're a minority? So that makes them even more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, once we were, actually, when I say we, I've been, one of the research projects that I worked on was for rural women making change, and I worked with Dr. Carrie Previs, and we did some workshops with the women themselves to make sure that we were analyzing all of their stories and, you know, their situation well, and then we also took all of those analysis and the lessons learned from the women to healthcare practitioners, service providers in the communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the message that we got from some of the community workers.
Okay.
That, you know, they were still basically not listening about how vulnerable women are because of those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like, you know, with my research too, like, I've decided to focus all of my doctoral research on women's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told, you know, why am I bothering you if there's not very many women coming into these programs? And then I always say, how many women have to be present in order for women to count?
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the barriers to health that women face. What are some other challenges that they face in the workplace?
Well, a lot of sexual harassment that goes unreported.
Okay.
A lot of women don't know where to go for help. And then when you do go for help, there's no guarantee that anything will be done. Most of the time, the only recourse that they have is to go back to Mexico or back to their other home country,
mm-hmm.
get away from their situation, to get away from their situation. There was a case in Leamington with some workers who were being harassed, and at the end by the employer, and at the end, basically the employer got away with it all. And there was an article that was so shocking that came out in one of the rural papers from there that basically said that this man is like an upstanding citizen, and he didn't really do anything to the migrant women. He wasn't harassing them. She just, you know, brushed over their bodies, you know, by accident or something of that sort. And the women were ready to testify.
Wow.
But they weren't allowed to. They weren't, you know, their voices were not heard. So that also sends a message that, you know, if women are going to risk it all and denounce sexual harassment cases,
mm-hmm.
most of the time, you know, the person who's going to be believed are the people who already have the power.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, which are the employers,
mm-hmm.
who represent a lot of power, like in the countryside, and that's what is so interesting for me and so tragic to see. Like whenever I go out every weekend to see the workers, I just drive an hour and a half means that the reality completely shifts and the reality completely changes, and it's incredible the amount of power that employers have in rural Ontario. They basically own rural Ontario. So right now with the Supreme Court decision, there's ways that we could perhaps fight it, like politically,
mm-hmm.
If we lobby strong enough, but we would be hitting the lobbying power of Canadian farmers,
mm-hmm.
Canadian employers, who actually say that if workers have the right to unionize, that they won't be able to their families anymore. There is like this ideology that they're promoting, which is completely untrue. And in my research, I talk a lot about how, you know, when we think about migrant workers, if we, you know, dare to think about where our produce our local produce comes from, the mm-hmm. local produce that they see that is supposed to be healthy for us
mm-hmm.
and good for us to buy because it stimulates our local economy and promotes local farming. We don't see who really is producing all of this produce.
Mm-hmm. I'm imagining right now the ad for what's it called? It has all these nice fruits and vegetables, and it says Ontario the Good.
Oh no, those I can't. My stomach turns whenever I see those ads, either in print, on radio, or on TV.
Yeah.
But I always think about the workers and their families, the mm-hmm. children left behind, the women who are taking care of the children who are connected to the migrant workers who are here. What about those families? You know, a lot of Canadians, a lot of the farmers are saying, oh, you know, they're supposed to destroy the Canadian family farms. You know, if you want to talk about families, let's talk about the transnational families that are embedded in agriculture
mm-hmm.
and our economy that we're also connected to. So basically, you know, those arguments, what they're doing is they're engaged in a bio warfare, basically saying that Canadian families are much more valuable than the families from the global south. You know,
mm-hmm.
the Mexican families, the Guatemalan families, the Jamaican families. So this is pitting like family against family, basically, and we can't eliminate here the race issue.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing about, since I know you're very focused on health, one of the things that also gets to me a lot is that, you know, buying local and is supposed to be healthy for us because, you know, we get more fresh produce. But what happens if this produce is making the people who grow it and cultivate it every day sick?
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there was a case that was documented in Araon Mendiburu's documentary, Migrants, Those Who Come From Within, that if you haven't seen that movie, you should definitely watch it because it tells a story of the families left behind. And in that documentary is a story of Alicia, whose husband was doused with chemicals in a greenhouse in Leamington where he was working with tomatoes.
Mm.
And he wasn't allowed to shower or to go to the doctor. The manager just said he was going to be okay, to go back to work. Well, after those chemicals, he was never the same again. He had to go back to Mexico because he couldn't, you know, handle his health anymore. He
mm-hmm.
wanted to be with his wife and child.
Mm-hmm.
And once he returned to Mexico, he died a month after.
Mm.
And so those are the casualties of our tomatoes, of our local produce, that we don't see it here at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then Alicia, her idea was to, the only way that she could, you know, afford to survive, she was thinking the only way that she could do that is by coming to Canada herself through this program. So, you know, so when widows are faced with that situation, they see their, you know, the program as their insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
But then with Justicia's work, you know, we are all volunteers in this work. And I've had to structure my life in order for me to do this work. And I've lived in Mexico for the last 5 years, half of the year,
mm-hmm.
half here, half there. And 1 year I was in this community in Cuisingo, and somebody else from Justicia, British Columbia, was also there. And we talked to Alicia and came up with an idea of her making us the bags. Justicia tote bags as an alternative, as a way to help her out, so that way she didn't have to come to Canada. Well, we sold so many of those bags
mm-hmm.
for her that she opened up a little store in
mm-hmm.
her town. And like, so that's just like a little story of, you know, of what to do when the state fails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we should be using these connections that these transnational networks that are being developed through this migration for the benefit of workers and their families.
Mm-hmm. So, acknowledging that the work that migrants do in Canada is often exploitative, what do you see as kind of actions that can be taken, or what would you like to see specifically in terms of improving women's rights in the workplace?
I think that when it comes to women, we haven't explored all the strategies. Okay, since we many times, like, the work that we do is ad hoc, we're putting out fires, but we obviously, all of us engaged in this work, whether it's in the formal labor movement or us in the grassroots labor movement, we have to step it up now more than ever. So one of the things that I'm thinking of with when it comes to women is we have to use international law as a shaming tool. You know, the international law has a limited seat, mm-hmm. but that's just one avenue that we can take with CEDAW. CEDAW has a whole section on rural women that we haven't explored. And the reason why I think that there's something there for us is also because Canada has ratified CEDAW. It hasn't ratified it hasn't ratified the UN Convention on the Protection of the Rights of all migrant workers and members of their families in so long.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to continue to use a multi-pronged strategy, not focusing on the legal, because as we know, the law has failed us.
Mm-hmm.
We have to definitely do more ad-busting. Migrant workers have, in my past conversations with workers many years ago, a lot of them were ready to do like ad-busting work to counter, you know, those images, those picturesque images that we are sold about the world through Foodland Ontario,
mm-hmm.
so that way they can be seen. So they need to be seen more by the public. You know, it's really hard for me sometimes to, since I'm in, you know, I'm so immersed in these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I forget sometimes that people don't know where our produce comes from. But I'm very, very disturbed when we give talks in environmental studies departments where there are a lot of local food activists from, you know, university educated who you think would be knowledgeable about all these issues, who do not even know that migrant farm workers come here to produce most of the food that they're promoting.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, even when it comes to organic farms, last year, two Jamaican brothers were killed in an organic farm. So just because a farm is organic doesn't mean that it's more safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to raise awareness. We need to strengthen the networks that we already have with the community legal clinics,
mm-hmm.
where we could, you know, use, well, we have to see how much we could use the law within, you know, like more of like the micro level within the level of a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
We're meeting with the Law Commission on the 8th of May. But all of these legal strategies, if we were going to deal with the law even at the micro level, they have to be met with direct action. So I'm sorry, if migrant workers are going to call for another protest and take their resistance to the public, because they're always engaging in their own way, their own resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there's a bit of noise in the background. But most of this resistance is at the individual level, you know, at the personal level, you know, within their workplaces, and that we don't see all the time. So we have to accentuate what they're already doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if migrant workers want to take their... if they want to take their struggles public, we have to support them all the way. So I hope that these mainstream institutions that, you know, are also, you know, adamant about getting the permit by the OPP,
mm-hmm.
I hope they understand that, you know, that we can't limit it anymore with our strategizing. And, of course, we need to also step it up within the home countries. And this is not just about us going down there and representing workers. No, this is about us, you know, really engaging with workers to make sure that they take leadership and their voices are heard in their own movement. Like one of the premises of Justicia is that we don't speak for migrant workers. They have mm-hmm. their voices, and they have a plurality of voices. They are not all saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So our job is to ensure that we create more spaces for workers to speak without danger. So we have to minimize the risk of them coming forward. And we're doing that in the Niagara region, for instance. We've been supporting in the background Dignidad Obrera Agricola Migrante, which in English means something like dignity of migrant workers. And workers that want to have their own autonomous spaces to articulate their interests and their demands. And when the last time I was in Mexico, for instance, instead of me giving a whole presentation about my research, I used that opportunity to get Maquila women mm-hmm. that work in the export processing zones, together with women from the Seasonal Cultural Workers Program, to talk about their own experiences and their own words. And then that way, you know, women came together and they learned about each other's struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the work that we have to continue doing. And and there could be, and tomorrow hopefully we'll wake up to another Canada. So we have to work with whatever government is in power, but we know that depending on who's going to be in power, we'll just see how easy it is to get a seat at the table for them to listen to us and promote these rights. So I don't have all the answers, obviously, but Anita, we have to step it up in all of our strategies, and it has to be a multi-pronged strategy.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. That's all the time we have, unfortunately, but we'll link to Justicia's website.
Thank you. That'll be great. And if anybody has more questions, please email us. I'm the one that answers emails, so I'll try my best to respond to you as
great. As possible. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.